Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 14, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on food labeling and genetically modified organisms, sponsored by our Litigation Practice Group. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a possible podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts. The first is Mr. Stephen Gardner, who is of counsel at the Stanley Law Group, and the other is Mr. Kenneth Lee, who is a partner at Jenner & Block. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you notice of the call, so I'll stop there and reserve more time for their presentations, followed, as always, by your questions. So I think we're going to get things started with opening statements. So, Mr. Gardner, the floor is yours.
Thank you. To give you all a background of where I'm coming from, I've been a plaintiff's consumer lawyer for going on 40 years. For the last 10 until last December, I was litigation director at Center for Science and the Public Interest. I am happy that I now no longer have to say that my views may or may not be the views of CSPI, because some of them aren't. I want to talk first briefly about GMOs. I kind of presume that y'all are all familiar with GMOs and the extent to which they are in our food supply, but just to make sure, GMOs, genetically modified organisms, called by people who like them, genetically engineered or GE crops, you can usually tell if someone is pro-GMO, they don't call it GMO, they call it GE. It just is a happenstance, kind of like calling garbage men collection engineers. The use of GMOs for our basic foods has grown just exponentially in the past couple of decades. Almost all the corn that you get in packaged goods is going to be genetically modified. Almost all the soy that you get will be genetically modified. There are some exceptions. If you get an organic product, it cannot have a genetically modified ingredient. So any organic product with corn or soy would not have the GMO version. The other interesting to me change that's coming down the pike is sugar. Sugar cane, the last I talked to my good friend Andy Briscoe, head of the Sugar Association, there does not have a GMO variety, although I have read that they are developing one. But all or virtually all of sugar beets are GMO, and because they tend to be cheaper to turn out, you are going to probably see GMO sugar in most packaged goods. And the reason I have to say probably is I don't know any more than y'all do. Vermont is the only state so far that has passed a mandatory GMO labeling bill. I'll talk more about that in a moment. The question of whether or not GMOs are natural is a secondary question. The survey evidence I've seen, including a really solid one from Consumer Reports, I believe about a year ago, shows that consumers overwhelmingly, somewhere in the 70 to 80 to 90% range, do not believe a product labeled natural would have a GMO in it. The problem is with packaged goods, at least those under the FDA's jurisdiction, is that despite pretty much every interested party asking FDA to come out with a regulation that defines natural, CSPI suggested that all it had to do was photocopy the USDA's definition of natural, which is basically minimally processed, something that does not require a lab or a significant chemical or enzymatic reactions to create, but it has not done so. Therefore, you see a whole lot of companies slap the word natural on their product, and you've seen, some of y'all may have defended them. There have been hundreds of lawsuits filed against companies that have used natural in a deceptive fashion. The reaction I hear from most defense lawyers, at least when they're talking publicly, is FDA hasn't defined it. There is no definition of natural. And my response is always to pick up a dictionary and refrain from hitting them over the head with it and just open it to the definition. It's multiply defined. Companies know what consumers believe it means. And when it comes to consumer fraud, that's all that matters. Companies know what consumers believe, and they take advantages of those beliefs. And I don't know if I have seen a product that would meet a definition of natural that is using the word natural on its box. What tends to be the practice is that companies who don't want to bother with the expense or trouble of turning out an actual natural product will just slap the word natural on it so they can steal business from people, companies that actually do make the product that is fully natural without question. This is a marketplace failure. It's an unfair competition, often against smaller companies by the large food manufacturers, and it's also denying consumers choice. I believe that, I know for a fact that consumers have a right to participate in capitalism. They have a right to make their own decision, even if I might think it was wrong, but they have a right to make it based on an informed choice. What we see with natural in general is that companies are trying to do the opposite of that. Rather than providing consumers the information they need, they're trying to tell them that a product is natural. Similarly with GMOs, companies such as Bayer, ADM, that make GMO products have gone out of their way to try to keep that salient point of information off of food labels. They fight like the dickens. I live and practice in Oregon. A ballot referendum last fall to require labeling failed by just a few hundred votes, and I think it could be attributed to the millions of dollars that the agribiz folks spent to prevent consumers from finding out whether or not they had a product with a GMO in it. I have long pushed for FDA to define natural. And another marketplace inefficiency is that we should have a clear definition and companies comply with it so that only the outliers are acting illegally instead of regulation by hundreds of lawsuits. Somebody asked me if litigation was the right way to approach labeling fraud, and I think I borrowed and paraphrased Winston Churchill by saying that litigation was absolutely the worst way to approach labeling fraud, except for all of the other ways. And that's because the FDA isn't doing anything. And with that, I'll pass it to Ken.
Great. Thanks, Steve. I think Steve gave a very useful background on GMOs and all natural labeling. I mean, he is one of the experts in this area. And when he was at CSPI, he was a thorn to many food companies and was very active. But I'll say he was always fair. And now that he's in private practice, I'm sure he'll still be active and hopefully still fair to us on the defense side.
I only have one speed.
And you know, I want to briefly go and discuss some of the case law regarding GMOs and all natural, and provide a bit of an overview. And as Steve mentioned, there have been dozens and dozens of lawsuits focusing on GMOs, and the primary focus has been on all-natural labeling, saying that a product cannot be described all-natural if any of the ingredients, you know, it's usually corn or soy, were potentially made from GMO crops. Despite these dozens of lawsuits, there's actually relatively little case law so far in this area, in part because a lot of these cases have settled or in many cases, they're still too early, in the early stages, such that there hasn't been much case law. I mean, there's clear, so far there's no case that directly addresses whether GMOs are natural or not. There have only been a couple of cases even on the class cert stage about GMOs and natural foods. Most of them have been still in the early stages, at the motion to dismiss stage, where companies have tried to dismiss these cases, saying GMOs are should be considered natural. Most of the times, courts have denied the motion to dismiss, but there have been, as far as I'm aware, I think three court opinions where the courts have dismissed all natural lawsuits. They haven't been GMO lawsuits. But the similar principle applies, and in these three cases, essentially the courts have, you know, adopted the reasoning and logic that natural, at least in the context of packaged foods, really doesn't mean anything, that there's no uniform definition, because packaged foods, by their definition, require some kind of human intervention and some processing to have to be in that form and to have that shelf life. Therefore, you know, they can't move past the pleading stage. I think the most recent one was in Missouri, federal court in Missouri, the case called Kelly versus Cape Cod potato chips. Again, not a GMO case, but you know, the allegation was potato chips had certain artificial ingredients, and therefore they could not be described as all natural. The federal judge there dismissed the case at the pleading stage, saying potato chips, everybody knows they're processed foods, therefore what does natural mean in that context? And there have been two other cases in California where two different judges have dismissed all natural lawsuits as well. One involved spaghetti. The case name is Pelayo versus Nestle, and the judge there said, you know, spaghetti, boxes of spaghetti and pasta products don't grow in the wild. What natural means, it's subjective, depends on, you know, what person you ask, and if you don't provide a plausible, objective definition of natural, you haven't plausibly articulated your theory of the case. And then there's another case called Balser versus Hain Celestial that involved cosmetics, and the court there said, well, everyone knows cosmetics definitely aren't natural. They're obviously processed and manufactured, therefore you can't pursue such a lawsuit. Again, these are most of the cases move past the pleading stage. You know, most of the judges say that requires at least some discovery. But at least some courts have at least put a line in the sand with respect to all natural lawsuits, saying that you know, it's not a plausible theory. Again, these were not GMO cases, but I think similar logic could apply to a GMO case, saying whether GMOs are natural or not is it really depends on who you ask. You know, if you ask the FDA, FDA hasn't issued any definitive statement. In fact, I think in one of the cases, the issue was presented. The court actually asked the FDA under the primary jurisdiction doctrine, asking, can GMO foods be labeled natural? And the FDA kind of punted that. But FDA has issued certain policy statements in the past, I think in 1993 and 2001, where the FDA said that GMO ingredients are substantially equivalent of GMO ingredients. Now, they really don't see any substantive difference between the two, and took the position that GMOs are essentially a one-step extension to just traditional plant breeding, you know, where you people would breed different type of plants to get certain qualities or hybrid fruits. And in fact, the FDA suggested that if a food company suggests that a non-GMO product is superior to GMO products, it actually may be misleading. So there's some ambiguity there. Again, no court has directly addressed these on the merits, but the difficulty of predicting of how courts will rule, I think, is most apparent in the two relatively recent cases involving GMO products. Both of them involved actually cooking oils. The allegation was they were derived from GMO ingredients, and they were up for class certification, and two different courts came to the two different conclusions. You know, one certified the class and another denied certification. In one of the cases in Florida, the court denied certification, and one of the bases was that on the definition of natural, saying whether someone thinks GMO products are natural or not, there's no objective definition. You ask one person, someone will say it's natural. Others will say no. And I think this is GMO all natural cases a little bit more complex than your typical other all natural cases where you have an ingredient where it's either artificial or natural. It's a little bit easier to ascertain that as opposed to GMOs, which, you know, one could make the argument it is natural because there's no artificial or synthetic ingredient being introduced. You're splicing certain genetic materials which are natural and putting them into another plant. So you can make the arguments natural. Obviously, the other side will say, no, there's nothing natural about it because you need a human intervention to splice certain genetic materials and place it into another plant. But it's murky enough that some courts, at least this one court in Florida, said, no, you can't certify a class because, you know, how do you determine whether throughout the class they will believe GMO-based ingredients products are natural or not. On the flip side, another court in California certified a class involving cooking oils again and said, there's enough evidence that some people may believe GMO-based food products are not natural, and that the judge didn't address the actual merits, but said, well, at least enough for class cert and certified a class. Again, there are different products, but the same category of products, cooking oils. So it'll depend on the judge's proclivities, the evidence, and obviously the arguments, but it's a very unsettled area of law. Not much out there, definitely nothing on the actual merits, but, you know, at the class search stage and even at the motion dismiss stage, there isn't much case law here. I'm sure as these cases progress further, there'll be more guidance, and, you know, perhaps later on, even an appellate court will opine on this area of law. With that, I'll give it back to Steve if he has any further comments.
And if he remembers to unmute his phone. There is a second decision out of the Northern District of California, the Reese versus Arizona Beverages, where the judge certified a class based on natural claims. And this is what I think is interesting, saying that when the company brought a motion for summary judgment, that the defendants had presented pretty crappy evidence, some scientist shooting his mouth off saying, sure, it's natural. But the plaintiffs, according to the opinion, had not submitted anything other than like a definitional insistence. He granted summary judgment, but before that, he decertified the class. It's a very, both of them are well-reasoned and informative decisions. And certification, it's Richard Seaborg. Judge Seaborg ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, but he decided that they had not met their burden in opposing the summary judgment. So that's well worth finding and reading. And Reese is R-E-I-S versus Arizona Beverages. The two points I'd like to make, and presentation was excellent, by which I mean not just thoroughgoing, but straightforward, and I don't have anything to disagree with him on. Damn you, Ken. But it doesn't matter what judges, lawyers, or scientists think the word natural means. I alluded to this. Under consumer protection laws, all that matters is whether or not consumers are deceived. And to determine that, it is not a strictly objective standard. It is indeed somewhat subjective, but you have to look at consumer testing to see whether or not consumers will be deceived into buying a product, whether or not had they known that a product had a GMO, would they have bought it if it was labeled natural? If it said made of all natural GMOs, would consumers have bought it? And if the answer is no, then that really ends the inquiry. A lot of courts are not getting to that point, but that is how the consumer law works. And just a short point on, can you discuss the court that said, you know, there's just no definition of natural, you know, all packaged goods are not natural. You're right that the few courts that have said that have reached the conclusion, therefore you can't sue. To me, the logical conclusion there is, if no packaged good is natural, then no packaged good can call itself natural. I don't agree with that. I think that, and nor do consumers, I believe that there are products that consumers would think are all natural products. Sugar, a box of pure cane sugar, for instance, consumers are likely to believe that that is natural. The fact it's undergone some processing doesn't mean it isn't. So it's bad logic to say that you can't sue over natural because no packaged food is natural. The conclusion from that should be that no packaged food can call itself natural, which is exactly what Consumer Reports has petitioned the FDA to do, to ban all uses of the word natural. So there.
Ken, any thoughts before we move to questions?
No, I think we can move to questions from callers.
Great. Well, in a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, press star and then the pound key. So, if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts, press star and then the pound key. Seem to have a quiet audience right out of the gate. While we're waiting for our first call, let me make one quick programming announcement. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is going to be this Friday, May 15th at 1 p.m. It's sponsored by our Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group on non-media speech, and that's going to be featuring Professor Eugene Volokh and Professor Sonia West. Again, and that is at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and that's Friday, May 15th. Our lines are still open for this call, so if you have a question or comment, press star and then the pound key.
You know, Ken, I always like to reassure myself when I speak and don't get questions that I've just really thoroughly covered the topic rather than stun people into resentful silence, but I know it could be either.
Well, that's the way we like to think of it here at the Society. We did have actually one question jump on, so we'll go to that, and then our lines will be open after that again.
Hey, hi, this is Martin Newhouse at the New England Legal Foundation in Boston. A very interesting presentation from both of you. I have a sort of a different question, which is various states are now passing legislation to require people who sell food, make food, to put a GMO label on their products. Do the states have that authority? I mean, is there a challenge to the state's ability to do that that would be viable?
No. You could try it. It would be a forced speech issue. Lord knows that the Grocery Manufacturer Association has sued to set aside the Vermont regulation and, that came out of the adoption of a mandatory labeling law. But I don't think it's going to fly. I suspect the First Amendment is high and often repeated in the GMA brief.
What about a preemption argument that
nope.
the FT?
Okay, I mean,
so the states
sorry,
have this. No, so the states have this ability, even though the FDA has federal authority.
The states and the FDA, there are decades of court opinions, including Supreme Court opinions, saying that under state duties and states' rights to protect their citizens, they can enforce their own food and drug laws, which usually parallel the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So it's the only preemption that's possible in food labeling is the preemption, the very specific types of preemption put in 1991 by the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act.
Okay.
You see some cases where courts find preemption in the food labeling area, but one of the reasons this one goes so well is there just ain't none.
Thank you.
One other comment I'll add is I think last month the Vermont federal judge, denied preliminary injunction. And I think, as Steve said, it was on First Amendment grounds where food companies challenged Vermont's GMO labeling law. The judge denied a PI, but I think the judge didn't dismiss the case either. So it will progress, and you know, perhaps the judge will address the merits of the issue, but it was, I think, only on a PI stage. And
I appreciate
one,
your mentioning that. That was my dim recollection, but I didn't want to shoot off my mouth on a dim one.
I guess the one other kind of interesting development, I guess, is not even the states, but I guess in the private sector, you know, Whole Foods announced last year that, you know, it's going to require GMO labeling for products in its stores starting in, I forget what it was, 2017 or 2018, and what impact that will have, you know, will be interesting to see.
Yeah. Thank you.
You know, it's I am looking forward to seeing what Whole Foods can get it in the natural foods arena. It is the big gorilla, and I think it's quite likely that it will have much the same effect that Walmart has for everything else, including organic foods. Walmart is so big that it can just tell companies that they will, several years ago, stop putting boxes around deodorant. So they'll stop having bulk packaging that's wasteful, and the companies are not going to do one-offs for Walmart. If Whole Foods is requiring it, then I think we're going to see more of it, and that's just the marketplace working.
Well, it looks like we had one more question jump on the line, so we will go to it.
David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. You know, apart from the issues that have been discussed, I'd like to ask both of the presenters whether or not they're aware of any cases of actual harm, I mean, either short-term or long-term health consequences that are underlying the concern and anxiety about genetically modified foods, and whether or not the presence or absence of that is taken to effect perhaps at a secondary level by the regulatory agencies or the courts in evaluating these types of issues.
I went first last time. Ken, you want to go?
Sure. The FDA's position has been that there is, you know, no evidence of, you know, any of GMOs being, you know, less healthy or more dangerous. In fact, you know, the FDA said they're, you know, substantially equivalent to non-GMOs. I think there have been some studies, you know, that I think a lot of the non-GMO proponents cite to a couple of studies that said that there could be, you know, with testing with rats, that, you know, if you give substantial amounts to certain rats, develop cancer. But I think that study has been criticized, and I believe the publication actually withdrew that article because of criticisms of methodology of that study. And I think there are the true believers who think it is dangerous, but I think probably the more popular view and probably the more reasonable view of non-GMO proponents is that there hasn't been enough studies. I think their position is that we just don't know enough. GMOs came to the market in the United States in the 90s, and we just don't know enough, I think, is their claim. I don't think too many people claim that it's not as healthy or it poses any health risks.
You're right, as what the FDA has done or failed to do, but that illustrates a failure of regulation at the FDA, which in 1997 proposed a regulation allowing companies to make their own determinations as to whether new food ingredients were generally recognized as safe. It published that and then immediately put it into effect, and 18 years later, it has still not done anything. The similar thing here, one of the concerns of the opponents is simply that this is a brand new kind of thing, and we just simply don't know what the effects are. As a rule, we shouldn't be putting ingredients into our foods until we know whether or not there are any short-term or long-term effects. However, I don't think on the question of damage, there's two answers. One is, we're talking financial damage. We're talking pocketbook damage. People have wasted their money, and other companies that make natural products have gotten cheated out of a sale. It's purely financial. In fact, in the lawsuits that CSPI was involved in, CSPI's scientists took the position that the difference between high fructose corn syrup, which is not natural, and sugar in terms of your health was infinitesimal, leaving out the GMO aspect. But I have not seen any real studies on this one way or the other, but I have followed the discussion and the consumer interest in the marketplace. And the discussion about GMOs is not, is it going to hurt me, but is it going to hurt the environment? Are bees dying off? The science on that is really developing, that the use of GMO products that are the glyphosate resistant products are having a direct effect on the bee and butterfly and other populations, are killing them off. That's what at least a potential cause of the colony decline. A secondary concern to individuals is what the effect is if we go all GMO, as to whether a few companies will basically own all the corn and wheat in Africa in 20 years. It's whether or not we want to concentrate food production within a few multinational companies rather than letting small companies participate as well. Those are concerns that have nothing to do with safety. So those also calculate in why people want to know whether or not the product has GMOs.
All right. Well, our lines are still open, and we still have plenty of time. So if you'd like to get a question in for either of our experts, press star and then the pound key. Well, it looks like we may have exhausted our questions, but before we still have plenty of time, but I just want to give both of our speakers an opportunity to give any final thoughts, any points that you talked about that you'd like to elaborate on, or anything that came up that you'd like to say in conclusion.
I think I've spit it all out, Ken.
Yeah. It's one final point I would make, and this is in keeping with what Stephen had said earlier, where he said no court has yet addressed, on summary judgment or a trial, the issue of whether a consumer, reasonable consumer, would be misled by the term all natural or natural for GMO products. That is true. No court has done so. And, you know, I think the evidence is, you know, depending on how you look at it, all over the map. On the defense side, you know, obviously the easiest or the most fruitful way to defeat these cases is at the class search stage. Because, you know, if you can show, you have to show that a reasonable consumer would be misled. If you can show that there's enough ambiguity, enough subjectiveness, at least some courts will say, you know, gee, you know what, this may not be amenable for class treatment. There's just too much variation. So that actually, on the defense side, is probably the most important way. It doesn't directly address the merits, but it adds enough doubt and ambiguity that a court may decide not to certify a class.
Well, I want to remind everyone that if you missed any part of this podcast or this telephone call and you'd like to re-listen, within several days this will be posted on our website as a podcast, and you can also find all of our previously recorded telephone conference calls at fedsoc.org. So in conclusion, I'd like to, on behalf of the Federal Society, thank both of our experts today, Stephen Gardner and Ken Lee, for joining us. Thank you to our audience for calling in, for your questions. We always invite your feedback at info@fedsoc.org. And stay tuned for new telephone conference calls being added almost daily on the schedule. So until next time, we're adjourned. Have a great afternoon, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.